the most difficult part of all of this is not necessarily to understand the ideas, but to overcome existing paradigms in order to accept new ones.
Ladies and gentlemen,
paranormal evidence gives us examples of the spontaneous materialization of information. One of the features of my work, Tim, was to identify this concept of information, not only as part of the way to measure or look at the universe or understand it, but it's the fundamental paradigm of the universe. It is the pinnacle of every aspect of reality that we can analyze and observe and describe. There's every indication that this information comes from an area or a realm or a dimension outside of the four dimensions of space-time. Now, scientists don't normally like to look at it this way because it drags physicists into a place where here be monsters, and they just don't want to go there. But I could take a scientist and drag him by force to the table.
And now, ladies and gentlemen, Banal of America Audio, with your host, Tim Banal.
What is going on, my friends? This is Tim Banal of BanalofAmerica.com with another edition of BOA Audio Season 7, coming at you here with the concluding portion of our double episode week, as we've already rolled out the baseball special, and now we provide you with a pure esoteric edition of the program. On this installment of BOA Audio, we welcome author Thomas Fusco for a discussion on his groundbreaking book, Behind the Cosmic Veil. And over the course of this lengthy conversation, we are going to dissect Thomas's theory on the nature of the universe and learn how it may explain the way paranormal phenomena manifest themselves. We'll also talk about the predictive nature of his theories and the challenges of getting his work recognized by mainstream science. Since I knew going into this conversation that Thomas's theories are richly detailed and quite complex, I opted for the classic BOA Audio style of really letting Thomas unpack these theories and explain them with as much time as he needed. Altogether, it is an engrossing edition of the program, which may provide a whole new perspective on the world around you as Thomas Fusco takes us behind the cosmic veil. For those of you who are unfamiliar with Thomas Fusco, please allow me to provide you with a little background on him. Thomas Fusco has devoted nearly three decades of research into the relationship between mind, physics, spirituality, parapsychology, scientific anomalies, and paranormal phenomena, with the goal of uncovering the unifying cosmological framework that has eluded mankind for generations. Since the publication of his book, Behind the Cosmic Veil, in the summer of 2011, Thomas has appeared on over 200 national and international radio programs to detail his remarkable theories. His website is www.cosmicveil.com. Pretty simple, all one word, cosmicveil.com. Check it out. And with all that said, let's get down to business, my friends, and rock and roll. This interview was recorded on February 7th, 2013. Thomas Fusco takes us behind the cosmic veil on BOA Audio Season 7. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to another edition of BOA Audio Season 7. I have a feeling you are in store for a very compelling conversation here this week. Our guest is Thomas Fusco. He's the author of the book, Behind the Cosmic Veil, A New Vision of Reality. Chances are you've heard him on a whole bunch of different programs he's done.
a wealth of appearances over the last year talking about this book and his theories. He is an independent researcher who has devoted nearly three decades investigating the relationship between mind, physics, spirituality, parapsychology, scientific anomalies, and paranormal phenomena, with the goal of uncovering the unifying cosmological framework that has eluded mankind for generations. So he's got a lofty goal here. This is going to be exciting. We're going to talk about his theories and his research and a whole bunch of other stuff. So, like I said, it's been a long time coming. Thomas actually sent me the book quite a while ago, and as longtime listeners of the program know, I am the master of procrastination and ill-fitting scheduling. So we finally got around to it here in the new year, getting Thomas on the show. So I'm really looking forward to the conversation. Thomas Fusco, welcome to Banal of America Audio.
How's it going, Tim?
It's going well. I'm excited to get you on the show finally. Like I said, it's been a long time coming and definitely a conversation I've been looking forward to having. And, of course, folks can find out more at CosmicVeil.com, and you spell Veil, V-E-I-L, not Veil like Veil, Colorado. So don't make that mistake, folks. Thomas, let's start out, you know, with the standard bio background. Who is Thomas Fusco, and, you know, how did this whole journey for you unfold?
Well, for me, I think, like most people that get into these alternate genres of study, I had some experiences, you might call them parapsychological, in my teens and early 20s that were profound enough to cause me to call into question the model of reality that was taught to me in physics. But rather than to go into an experiential type or a practicing type of avenue with these, it was definitely theoretical for me. The compelling question became, how could the universe possibly be put together that would explain how these things could occur? And so my research over the decades has focused on that, looking at many, many different sources and gathering an awful lot of data and reported observations to gel them into a logical model that answers the pertinent questions that are addressed to it. And that's what's in my book.
Like I said that earlier here, you know, you got this lofty. This is a pretty serious sort of big picture examination of, like I said, the unifying cosmological framework that has eluded mankind for generations. That's pretty serious stuff. We're not, you know, you're not just trying to figure out where UFOs come from or, you know, whether or not Bigfoot's real.
Absolutely, and my approach is a little different in that way. You know, it's kind of like looking at the top down. Most investigators and researchers in these kinds of fields focus on their particular area of interest. But for me, the picture was much bigger than that. We had to talk about some very fundamental natures or qualities of the universe itself. Because not only do we have these paranormal or supernatural type phenomena and observations that we're dealing with, but there are persistent problems and anomalies that we have in mainstream conventional physics that continue to defy any type of a explanation or a conclusion on them. And so I kind of lumped this all together and said, look, we need to come up with some sort of a conceptual model that helps us to understand all of these kinds of mysteries.
It's sort of like a unified field theory. You're trying to come up with, like, sort of the overarching, why does this happen sort of thing, which I think is important because otherwise we need a roadmap, if you will.
Yeah, in physics it's called a theory of everything.
Or there you go, yeah.
OA. And all of these kinds of theories have to start out with some sort of a conception as far as the concept of it. Einstein did, of course, incredible work with relativity, and there's a whole lot of math. He worked for a decade on the mathematics on it. But they originally, his work originally started with some basic premises that were really concepts. They were visualizations. And so, you know, that's the starting point, and this is where I feel that I've been able to make a lot of progress.
Right, right. At the risk of sort of we laughed about this at the beginning of the conversation before we started the show, but at the risk of, like, giving the book away, can you tell us sort of the theory? Can you tell us the, you know, something we can dissect it a little bit?
Oh, absolutely.
Okay, like I said, I didn't want... You know, I didn't want to give away the secret here, but it's a kind of critical to the conversation. So fire away with this theory, and hopefully I can follow along on this.
Okay,
because I'm concerned. Science gives me a rash, so I don't.
Well, again, what I try to do is to keep everything in, you know, relatively easy to understand conceptual models. I don't talk about, you know, mathematics or get into any particular avenue too deeply in the book itself, just the basic principles. And, you know, the most difficult part of all of this is not necessarily to understand the ideas, but to overcome existing paradigms in order to accept new ones. And, of course, that's very common to the human condition. We don't like to change the way we look at the world. So, you know, to start out, what we needed to do, or what I needed to do, was to come up with some fundamental questions. And number one is basically the idea of information. Everything in the universe is assembled from information. And, you know, this is an established principle in physics today, the idea of information, so much so that we have now for some time an extension to the traditional laws of conservation. Everybody remembers in school hearing at least once, matter and energy can neither be created nor destroyed.
Right.
But what we have today in physics is an extension to that called quantum unitarity. And what that means is that the information from which matter and energy is assembled itself can neither be created nor destroyed. This implies that information underlies everything in the physical universe, all of its structures.
Now let me stop you here because I'm already confused. I feel like I sound like an ass, but what is information? Because it's such a nebulous sort of, I'm trying to wrap my mind around this. I'm trying, you know, because do you mean like atoms or what? Can I hold it in my hand, information?
Well, not really, but we understand, you know, for example, electrons are assembled in the exact same way everywhere in the universe.
Right.
There aren't multiple ways to assemble an electron. So an electron is assembled according to a certain set of instructions, so to speak.
Okay.
And these instructions are what we would call information.
Okay.
They are reflected. Information is reflected quite a bit in our mathematics. That, you know, mathematics follows a certain repeatable pattern, and that it reflects the way that the universe is put together. So, for example, if we look with our modern telescopes and other types of sensing devices at some of the most remote objects in the universe that we can see and observe, we can actually collect radiation signals from them, light waves, you know, different types of radiation, and we can do spectral analysis on those and find out a lot of information about that distant object, be it a galaxy or something else, how hot it is, how far away it is, how fast it's rotating, even some of the elements that comprise its constituents. All of that can be derived from the spectral analysis of its light because the mathematics that work here also work over there in the identical way.
Okay, so the information is kind of like fundamental laws, or if you will, or just, I have an idea of what you're saying now. So
yeah, you know, another way that I talk about it is, because you're right, when we use information in common language, we're not necessarily talking about the same usage when it comes to physics.
Hmm.
We have a number of words in physics like that. One of the problems with our theories involving black holes, and the laity or lay people don't normally realize that the classical model of the black hole that was expressed by Stephen Hawking is by no means universally accepted in the astrophysics community. All of those theories suffer from the destruction of information. And since we know that that is not possible, according to all the laws that we see, that it creates a stumbling block for us to really understand precisely what a black hole is and what it's doing inside.
Hmm.
Anyway, one of the features of my work, Tim, was to identify this concept of information not only as part of the way to measure or look at the universe or understand it, but it's the fundamental paradigm of the universe. It is the pinnacle of every aspect of reality that we can analyze and observe and describe. I liken it to a pyramid.
Okay.
Where all the Great Pyramid of Giza is supposed to have more than 2 million stones. If we could imagine all of these being unique in their shape and every one being a various aspect of physical reality, the fundamental paradigm of that structure would be the capstone. And that capstone would not only represent the shape of the entire structure, but once that was in place, all the other blocks would fall into line in their exact positions where they're supposed to be. So for me, information, the idea of information is that capstone, is the fundamental paradigm. So much so that it gives us a definition of what the universe is. And my definition of the universe is that it is an expression of materialized and materializing information.
Okay, so it's like the underlying fabric, if you will, of the whole universe.
Yeah, if we could pick one quality of the universe that we could speak in a sentence that would shed light on its entirety and some level of understanding, I've found no better idea than the idea that it is an expression of materialized information.
Okay.
Now, once we get there, once we have that, it immediately draws us to two further questions. What is the source of that information? And what is the mechanism by which that information materializes?
Yes.
And these are fundamental questions to reality. These are questions that are still being struggled over in physics, in mainstream physics. We do not understand how the universe achieved its incredible order. It should not have been so orderly based on our understanding of its early state and how it began. Our universe is so orderly that two atoms of hydrogen and one atom of oxygen combine together in a molecule, H2O, at standard temperature and pressure, and in the presence of a sufficient gravitational field to gather a collection of these molecules into a pool, creates a clear liquid we call water. Anywhere in the universe, those conditions exist.
Right.
So this is a mystery how this has come into being. We have other problems with the way that the universe is put together also, especially in quantum physics, where we actually see information materialize in a form with no physical source. Quantum entanglement's a good example. This is where we have, let's say we have two photons. They're in a correlated pair. They are separated. We separate them and allow them to travel away from each other at the speed of light. And in the correlated pair, they had a balanced spin. So particle A has an up spin and particle B has a down spin. And if we pass particle A through a filter that changes its spin, particle B immediately responds by reversing its own spin.
Right.
To maintain the balance of the pair, even if they're light years apart. This is physically were materially impossible.
Right. It's bizarre. It's like, how do they know?
Right.
It's like the old thing about the thermos. Keeps things hot, keeps things cold. How does it know the difference?
Yeah. And when you say no, Tim, that's a very important idea, because knowledge is information. And all knowledge is derived from information, and the very machine that we have, the human brain, that processes knowledge and reasons with knowledge, is also assembled from a coherent pattern of information. A distinct pattern, it's different from what is a tree is assembled from, or a granite rock is assembled from.
Hmm.
It's a way of looking at things in a little bit of a different light.
Right, right, exactly. So then how do you... I don't want to jump the gun here or cut you into the middle of your explanation, but then how do you drape the paranormal into all this?
Well, here we have a situation where we have, and again, let's step back for a minute.
Okay.
We're not looking at paranormal as a specific, as an exclusive field of study, but just another aspect of reality.
Right.
That we observe. Looking at it from that perspective, we see that paranormal evidence gives us examples of the spontaneous materialization of information. Most other objects in the universe, that process of materialization from its informational pattern or blueprint is completed and is so well established and sustained that we're not able to see the process taking place. But in paranormal phenomenon, we see it all the time. We see apparitions on occasion, which is a materialization of information within local space. People hear disembodied voices. A vocalization is a coherent collection of information of a specific pattern from which certain oscillation waves can emerge that come to our ears and are translated as meaningful sound, as opposed to like static from that you'd get from a TV in between channels or something.
Yeah.
So this gives us an ability to examine this kind of phenomenon and moreover to conduct certain experiments on it that this theoretical model of mine would predict. And this is another thing that's unique about my work, Tim, because it's not a quote-unquote theory. It's a scientific theory. And the difference is that scientific theories make predictions about aspects of reality that are not predicted by other theories, but are also experimentally testable.
Okay, well, let's talk about that a little bit then. Because when I hear prediction, I'm already imagining the sullied version of prediction that you hear on some other paranormal shows. But these are, as you say, like scientific predictions. Have you applied this and seen it at work?
Absolutely. And you're right, Tim. This is another word that means something different in physics.
Right.
Than it means in colloquial language.
Right. You're not telling me who's going to win the NBA championship here or anything like that. You're going to...
Absolutely. And sometimes in interviews, when I say that word, it takes me 5 minutes to reel everybody back in. Because they go off on a tangent and misunderstand what I'm trying to say.
Right, exactly. I understand what you're saying.
Give me an example. One of the greatest accomplishments of Einstein's relativistic theories is that he predicted that the actual fabric of space-time was warped and bent and curved around every physical object. This is very different than what was believed at his time, which was the Newtonian model that said that space was an empty void that was occupied by matter and energy that moved through time at a fixed meter. So Einstein said space was a substance. It was actually a substantive field that was characterized and defined by four independent variables, height, width, depth, and time.
Hmm.
And this is where we get the term space-time in four dimensions. Einstein changed the world. But in order to prove this theory, he had to make a prediction that would demonstrate that space is actually a substance and bends. So his prediction was this. if we took a photograph of a solar eclipse, a full solar eclipse, during an eclipse, the sun's light is blocked out from us, and consequently, the stars appear. They begin to become visible like they would be in the night sky.
Right.
And most people are familiar with this. What Einstein said, he said, take a photograph of that part of the sky. Now, later on, when the eclipse is not there anymore, compare that photo to a photograph of the exact same region of the sky and where you can see all the stars.
Right.
And he said, in the vicinity where the solar disk was, you will find a 1.75 degree variation in the position of the starlight coming to us between the two photos. And that difference was the bending of light around the warp of space around the sun. And it took 19 years until someone was ultimately able to successfully conduct this experiment. And when they found his very precise mathematical prediction to be absolutely true, it changed everything. It changed the world. And so that's what I mean by prediction.
Okay, so now how have you applied your works to predicting the paranormal? Because the paranormal is, you know, that's the big stumbling block for a lot of scientific-minded people. You know, it's unpredictable.
Absolutely. And in order to do that, we need to talk a little bit about these two fundamental questions.
Okay.
Where does the information come from? Where does the pattern or the database originate from? And the mechanism by which it materializes? Because we have to talk about those first in order to then make predictions about aspects of reality, and then we could talk about some of the experiments that have already been conducted to verify these predictions. There's every indication that this information comes from an area or a realm or a dimension, or however you would want to say it, outside of the four dimensions of space-time. For what we talked about before, for quantum entanglement to work, the information, the knowledge about the state of particle A being transmitted instantaneously across light years to particle B would require that information to travel at infinite velocity.
Right.
And there's no such thing as infinite values within the confines of the physical universe. Anytime that physicists, work mathematical equations to make certain predictions and to test certain theories, anytime they come up with a value of infinity, that's a red flag.
Right.
They know they've either done something wrong or they've left something out. So there is every indication that there is a body of information that exists outside of space-time, what I call above space-time. It is part of a superstructure of the physical universe. This is very different than conventional physics, which is derived from a paradigm of materialism.
Yeah.
In other words, standard physics today says reality is the physical universe. And the physical universe is reality. What my model says is reality is bigger than that. And that the physical universe is only a component, one part of what reality is. This idea of information existing outside of space-time, Tim, is nothing new. It's been around for a long time. From a kind of an analytical or scientific viewpoint, Plato was probably the first one who tackled it, and he called it forms. These forms are what everything was derived from. Carl Jung called them psychoid entities. The Bible, even, from a religious point of view, the Old Testament talked about the wisdom of God that fills this same kind of a requirement. And the New Testament, in the first paragraph of John, uses the philosophical Greek word logos. We translate it in English into word. But there is no English equivalent. It means matrix, pattern, mind, thought, order, structure. All of those things are wrapped into this logos.
Now, this information dimension, it's not like a place, right? It's not like something you can go to. It's sort of like in keeping with the four, you know, height, width, depth, you know, and information. Is that kind of how you're positioning this?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. That this is why one of the traditional paradigms that has run people into intellectual dead ends is the idea of higher dimensions. It is something that's almost a oxymoron because dimensions describe what is physical. So anything beyond the physical is most likely not dimensional. And so when we talk about higher dimensions and other dimensions, it leads us down avenues of thought that always terminate in a dead end.
Hmm.
There's no way that we can go past a certain point because we can't reckon it. We're trying to assign what I call super physical elements, physical attributes. We see this all the time. There's all kinds of confusions from different fields of alternate studies. For example, a term that we commonly hear is spirit energy. According to my model, that's a conflict in terms, because spirit contains a uniquely identifiable and distinct collection of information that is not physical, while energy is. Another thing that lay people are not normally familiar with, that they think matter is physical and energy is not. No, it's all physical. So spirit energy is an attempt to assign something that's non-physical, physical attributes.
Right.
Which why when you hear people starting to talk in greater detail about, quote, spirit energy, it starts sounding like nonsense after a moment or two, because they reach that intellectual dead end.
Hmm.
Saying spirit energy is like saying honest politician. You know, it's an oxymoron.
Yeah.
And the evidence to it is that it doesn't lead us anywhere. It doesn't. Energy is something that's measurable, you know, and it's quantifiable. So that idea makes no predictions that are experimentally testable beyond the idea that, you know, the human body appears to lose a certain amount of energy when it dies.
Hmm.
But that's very explainable by conventional physics, you know. All the energy generating systems shut down.
Right, right, exactly.
You know. Anyway, to get back to this idea, in the 20th century, this idea of what I call supergeometry, a superset of the geometry of space-time, is expressed in a number of different places. A few of the most prominent physicists of the 20th century, not fringe guys or quacks or anything like that, but mainstream, highly respected people like David Bohm, David Finkelstein, John Wheeler, all have their own versions of this idea of a body of information that exists outside of space-time and from which the physical reality of space-time emerges. So Finkelstein's is called coherent superpositions. He also calls it quantum topology. John Wheeler calls it pre-geometry, which kind of served as a root for what I came up with, supergeometry.
Hmm.
David Bohm called it implicate order. That was this structure that existed outside of space-time, but gave rise to what he called the explicate order of matter and energy, time and space. If we go, if some people follow the psychic type of, fields, Edgar Cayce called it the Akasha. It's the exact same idea. So with that in mind, let's take a look for a moment. Let's jump and take a look at paranormal phenomena.
Right, right. Let's tie all this together.
All right. Let's start putting it together.
Right. Put a bow on it.
Yeah, let's first look at the idea of information. and look at it from that paradigm. This is what I try to, express. Forget about the way you normally look at something in the paranormal, and look at it from this primary perspective first, as the fundamental perspective regarding information. paranormal investigative team, they get a call from a homeowner. We keep seeing this particular woman in the house. She appears, she disappears. You know, sometimes we see her so clearly that we can recognize the, you know, features of her face. What the heck is going on?
Right.
The team comes in, starts doing investigating. One of the team members goes to the public library or a place where they keep old newspaper files and starts looking for someone who lived in the house many years ago that may have be some sort of a center of this activity. And they find a woman, let's say, that died tragically 75, 80 years ago, and that they have a photo of her. And so they get the photograph, and they bring it in, and they show it to the residents. And they look at it in shock. And they say, oh, my gosh, this is the woman we're seeing. This is her. Remember we told you she looked like this and had these features? That's her.
Right.
All right. Now, how do we see this from a prospective or from a perspective of information? Let's take the original woman that lived 80 years ago. According to science, every part of her physical structure and all of her energetic patterns are assembled from a distinct collection of information that's unique to her.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? Now, there's a lot of interior to the body, but there's also an exterior that displays the outer part of that information, that set, that data set. So we get a device called a camera. A camera is able to record the information that's being transferred through its lens, piggybacked on to what we would call a carrier wave, which are the waves of light. So the information about the exterior of the woman is being conveyed via the carrier waves of light through the lens and onto the photographic plate.
Yeah.
And the reason why I'm talking about it this way is to have people to start thinking about it scientifically. What's actually happening, you know, in common language or in common thought. You know, we talk about seeing this and seeing that. From a scientific perspective, no human being has ever seen a thing. We are actually quite blind. All we can see is light that is emanating from or reflecting off a thing.
Right, right, exactly, yeah.
We cannot see a thing. And so when you start thinking about that scientifically, it gives your mind different avenues to think about it in a more accurate way. So here we have this data set that has been collected on this photographic plate, and it was developed, and we bring that data set in and show it to these individuals who recognize the data set as the same collection of information that they're seeing materialize in their house. So that would not be recognizable unless whatever is materializing in their house is being assembled from the same collection of information that created the woman and the recording on the film.
Right, exactly. It has to come from her.
Yes, or the body of information that defined her.
Mm, yes.
You see, that's the difference. Now, if this supergeometric realm, this domain, if you will, that Bohm talked about, that Wheeler talked about, that Finkelstein talked about, and all these people I mentioned earlier, according to their models, that information is stored independently of its materialization. You know, it's just like an extruder, so to speak. You know, with extrusion, they push a material through a shape.
Mm-hmm.
And it comes out extruded. That's how they make, cheese puffs and those kinds of things.
Right, right.
you can destroy the extrusion, the physical extrusion, and yet the machine that made it still exists. And the die from which that material was pushed through and shaped still exists independently of the product.
Hmm.
So the same body of information that assembled the physical woman 80 years ago is the same body of information that is forming the current apparition. Otherwise, the apparition would not be recognizable.
Now, that brings in, and I may be cutting you in the middle of this, so I apologize for that, but that, I guess the big question, though, is, and I don't know really if you sort of look at this, I presume you must, but it is the why question. Why is that happening, though? Why is the information leaking back into the present, if you will?
Well, there's a couple reasons that I think contribute to that. Now, one of them is intent. And I don't get too involved with intent, because I look at it in terms of investigating a crime scene, like a police department,
mm-hmm.
where you have criminology and you also have forensics. I'm on the forensics team. So I'm not going to talk about whatever intelligent motivation would result in this. But from a forensics point of view, space-time is a continuum. And most people don't understand what that word means. They hear it all the time, space-time continuum on Star Trek.
Yeah.
They don't know what it means. It means that it is a continuous field, that everything connects it to everything else. And so, when we encounter an object, there isn't an interruption of space-time, and then we have the object, and then space-time continues on the other side. Space-time continues right through the object. It's actually part of the object itself, what Einstein called a matter point within the fabric of space-time. So I believe that information works in the same way. It is a continuum, so that certain pieces of information are linked with other pieces of information. And so consequently, if somebody lived in that house, there's a part of that information that is connected to the body of information that the house is constructed from.
Mm, okay.
So there's a connection there. The other thing has to do with the bending of space. We're going to talk about that in a moment. I believe that human beings have the ability to affect the nature of physical reality around them, not only directly, but also with some sort of a spiritual influence, if for lack of any better word at the moment. And that causes changes in the space-time fabric of that particular area that helps encourage these kinds of spontaneous manifestations, which is why some places are haunted and other places are not.
Sort of like how some people are like mediums or whatever, they can see ghosts or something. Maybe that ability is more tuned up in them.
Well, I'm talking about what actually occurs in these haunted sites,
mm-hmm.
because a recording equipment has been known to pick up paranormal effects when nobody was present. So it has something to do with the location itself.
Okay.
And I believe it has to do with the fabric of space-time in there and how it's been altered.
All right.
So anyway, this idea of the picture being shown to the current residents and this collection of information being recognized as the same body of information that created or assembled the woman, the original woman 80 years ago, tells us two things. If we're going to accept this phenomenon as genuine, it tells us, number one, that information is stored in what we call in physics non-locally. It is not stored in any physical structure or at the location, because the woman was the physical storage medium.
Exactly, yeah.
The woman was the hard drive. The hard drive's gone. And yet this information still has a backup somewhere that is independent from its physical construction or the physical area. The other thing that it tells us is that the information can move through time.
Exactly, yeah, right. But if you're saying space-time's a continuum, isn't that implied, though, that the information, if it's part of the whole fabric, is also a continuum?
Yes, but it also implies that this information arises or is stored from a realm that is superphysical. In other words, it is not constrained by the dimensions of space and time.
I see, yeah. So it's not, yeah, exactly. Okay.
So if we take a look at Einstein's unified field theory and project it further backward in time to the beginning of the universe, it is the standard accepted model in physics today that the universe began with a Big Bang. And that bang emerged from something that wasn't physical. It was what they call a quantum singularity. And that singularity means everything was wrapped up in a singularity. There's no distinction between anything else. Everything is one. And they say it was infinitely dense and infinitely small. And what we talked about earlier, that infinite word, indicates that it can't possibly be physical. And yet it contained all the information from which all the physical universe arose in all of its structures and all of its laws and principles. In a pre-physical state, it existed independently of the physical. And they've existed independently of space and time because space and time didn't exist. So in this realm, the body of information that is materializing the woman 80 years ago and the body of information that's materializing an apparition today of that woman exists at the same moment. In that realm where it's stored, there is no 80 years. There is no years.
Right.
There is
right.
no time as we understand it.
It's timeless.
Yes, it's an eternal present. Or as God said to Moses, when Moses said, "Who should I say told me to tell you them all this?" He said, "Tell them I am," which was, in his primitive mind, the most accurate way that God could describe his eternity. Is tell them I am sent you. Very interesting aspect of a lot of different points in the Bible that say things that have not been recognized before for what their scientific significance is.
Well, that's not a surprise. You know, the Bible and science are almost natural enemies.
Yes. And, to try to reconcile them, in the past has taken a very awkward form. My work does talk about the Bible, and it talks about what I call the hidden cosmology, that's been hiding in plain view for centuries, and nobody's recognized these various points in it, and how they help draw us a picture of what's really going on.
Well, now, I can see how this theory could be applied to what you're talking about with ghosts and spirits and stuff like that, but what about some of the other, big tentpoles of the paranormal? I mean, it's a very interesting and grand theory, but in the sense that, like, let's just apply this to, like, Bigfoot. It's like, the simplest explanation is just this is some creature we haven't found yet. It doesn't need an overarching grand theory, but maybe I'm wrong. So, I mean, what do you think of that?
Well, it's a good question, Tim, because one of the things that I encountered, one of the stumbling blocks I encountered early on in my research and my work was to realize that the paranormal didn't have a good explanation. It didn't have a scientifically relevant definition.
Right.
And so in order to establish that and to take it out of this realm of being this catch-all basket for anything weird or strange or inexplicable that somebody dumps it into this paranormal category, what I ultimately came to was that paranormal phenomena or supernatural phenomena produces effects that are observable by way of this non-local causality that I was talking about earlier.
Mm-hmm.
That the effect is there. The effect is normal. The observation is normal. But the source isn't in our physical plane. It's coming from somewhere else. This idea of quantum entanglement of two, you know, particles separated by light years, and yet they instantaneously respond to the same information, is an example of non-local causality, or what we call non-locality for short, or what one author said, I wish I could remember his name. He said, it's like getting a black eye in Miami from a punch that's thrown in Cleveland. But that's kind of how it works. So when we look at paranormal as non-local, let's take a look as an example of a disembodied voice. That's a characterization of paranormally active locations. The voice itself is normal. We have a normal vocal compression wave, acoustic wave, that is oscillating at a certain frequency and amplitude, carrying certain information, being conveyed to our ears through the medium of the air. You know, we can't hear in a vacuum. So it has to be conducted by a medium. And it reaches our ears and we hear a voice. The difference between a normal and a paranormal voice isn't the effect. It's that in a normal voice, the cause, which would be a set of physical vocal cords, is locally connected to the vibrating air column that connects that oscillation with our ears. In a paranormal voice, there is no physical vocal cords. The voice appears to come out of nowhere. There is no physical cause local to the effect that is physically connected to the effect. It's just not there. So that gives us a sound scientific definition of the paranormal that also applies to other aspects of physics. It means that we can then say, if we're going to establish that as a definition for paranormal, we can then extend that to say that the phenomena, the quantum phenomena of entanglement, is paranormal.
I think so, yeah, yeah.
So we're giving it a specific definition and we're able to turn the table, so to speak. But if we apply that to Bigfoot, according to my criteria, the cause of the effect that we witness and observe is physical. So Bigfoot is not paranormal.
Okay, I see what you're saying, yeah. So you're sort of honing it in. It's important to do that because, you know, like you were saying, paranormal is like the word sports. You know, Bigfoot's very different from ghosts, which is very different from UFOs, so it's hard to really, you know, just like football is different from baseball and different from basketball.
Yeah, and you know, if we're going to analyze the actual physics of a baseball and how it's struck and with the bat and all that, we're obviously not talking about anything that relates to swimming.
Exactly, exactly.
And we have to make that distinction before we can begin to analyze it in, you know, in perspective.
Right.
And so, yeah, and another way I say it is that, you know, I believe that someday somebody's going to drag in a Bigfoot body. I don't believe that anybody's going to drag in a body of an apparition.
Well, exactly. By definition, an apparition has no body, I suppose, right?
Exactly. It has no local physical cause to the observed effect. So that's what makes it paranormal.
Right. Okay. Okay. This is already very fascinating. I'm deeply engrossed in this. So you talked about using this as a predictive model. So what have you, how have you applied it in that form?
Okay, this is where we get to this second aspect. We've talked about structure and form with this body of information. All right. What we're actually doing is kind of taking an Oriental approach to physics. The Oriental physics, the traditional physics, goes by the name of Wu Li. W-U-L-I. And that's a compound word that means form and substance. the metaphor would be if we looked at a snowflake. Its crystalline structure is its form, but the ice, the water molecules that it's made from, is its substance. So we have substance and form that comes together to create objects, structures. We've talked about the structure. Now let's talk about the form a little bit. And this is where we can make some very interesting predictions. The form would have to come from the materialization process. The information would shape that materialization into various structures. So, if that's the way the universe works, then we have to take a look at the substance of every object in the universe. What do they have in common? And here again, we're going to go back to Einstein's model of the continuous spatial field that he demonstrated, or he predicted, and it's been experimentally demonstrated thousands of times in the last 100 years, that space is warped and bent around every physical object. And moreover, what Einstein said is was gravity is a function of that bending of space. So we're going to talk about gravity a little bit, because, you know, gravity, Tim, is also paranormal.
Okay, yeah. Well, it's very mysterious, that's for sure.
Mm-hmm. And I'll explain what I mean by it being paranormal. In a normal local causality, there has to be a physical connection of a medium between cause and effect. Even when you receive a radio transmission, there's a wave coming from that tower, which is physical,
mm-hmm.
that conveys the information and connects it to your radio. There's a physical connection. Gravity, there is no physical connection. When we were taught in school about gravity, we were not taught in school about gravity. We were taught in school about gravitational effect. We were taught the assumed conventional explanation, the material explanation, that it is a force. And it is a force just like electromagnetism, or very similar to electromagnetism. It's an attractive force. This is based on the conclusions made by two of the greatest physicists of the 19th century, Michael Faraday and James Clerk Maxwell. They both concluded that this was a force. Unfortunately, every time we approach gravity as a conventional force, we run into snags. We come up empty-handed. We come up to these dead ends. And one of the fundamental ones is that if it is a force, it must manifest itself as a particle that propagates as a wave. Just like electromagnetism, we have an electron, which is the particulate form of electromagnetism, that propagates as an electromagnetic wave. And so these are fundamental qualities of a physical force. The other forces that we know of are the strong and the weak nuclear forces that work on the atomic level and are conveyed by bosons, which are specific types of particles that convey and propagate waves of force. When we've looked for a graviton, which is a particle of gravity, a gravitational boson, we have looked for that for decades and have never found any stitch of evidence that there is a particle of gravity. And consequently, we have no stitch of evidence that there's a wave of gravity. We know that gravity can make waves within the fabric of space-time. But just because you drop a stone in the water and it creates waves that go across the surface, doesn't mean those waves are a propagation of the actual stone. It's an effect caused by the stone.
Right, right.
Okay. So you're following me so far. So I'm not doing too bad at doing this in layman's terms, am I?
No, you're doing good. I'm just, I like to let the guests roll here. I'll let you unpack this.
That's great. All right. So anyway,
I'm waiting for you to get to the predictive nature of the model, though. I want to hear this.
Yeah.
I want to hear what you've predicted now I sound like I am confusing the term prediction, but I want to hear where this has been applied and it works out.
Yeah, and it's very important. But like we were talking about before the interview, it's like if you had if an author was talking about a suspense thriller.
Right.
You can't really talk about the ending until you talk about the plot.
Exactly, yeah. Absolutely.
We're talking about the plot right now. Gravity is one of the most strangest mysteries in the universe. And it is fundamental to understanding the universe, and we know very little about it. It's the same kind of puzzle, the same kind of, universal scale, this cosmological scale of a puzzle, just like where the order of the universe came from. They're hand in hand. These things are two of the greatest mysteries. So, for example, the problems we run into gravity. We can't detect a particle of gravity. We see no physical substance to gravity like we do with electromagnetism. So here we have this moon they taught us in school. The moon's held in orbit around the Earth because of gravity. No, the moon is held in orbit around the Earth because of gravitational effect.
Yeah.
In reality, to our best knowledge, there is nothing physical that connects the Earth and the Moon. There's nothing physical. So it's paranormal. We have all these effects we see in the universe, and there's no physical local connection connecting one to the other. It's just not there.
Right, right.
When Einstein tried to work his unified field theory equations, what he failed on is that he could not express gravity mathematically throughout the four dimensions, height, width, depth, and time. Couldn't do it. Today we have two great systems to describe reality and observable reality. We have relativity and we have quantum physics that, operates on the micro level. The reason why we haven't been able to reconcile that into a consistent, single model is because of gravity. We cannot reconcile gravity between these two forces or these two systems. In modern physics, we have what we call the standard model. You may have heard of it, capital S, capital M. It lists all the particles and all their interactions, the fundamental particles and forces of the universe. And this is where the Higgs boson is needed to fill a vacuum, a hole in that model. But what most people are not aware of is that that model has no hole, no place for gravity.
What is gravity then?
Well, here we go. This is what the mystery is. And this is where my paradigm gives us an insight on it.
Okay.
In fact, the standard model I was mentioning works rather well without even the consideration of gravity. That's bizarre. So what I say is this, the problem that we have with gravity is from looking at it from a material-centric point of view, which means that the physical object, like the Earth, generates gravity that then warps the space around the planet. This is the conventional model. What I say is something different. I say that the warping of space comes first, and then information materializes within those warps of space. This is what's truly revolutionary about this model. And it's not without precedent. I mentioned earlier about Einstein having difficulties, impossible to reconcile gravity in his unified field theory equation. Theodore Calusa was a contemporary of Einstein. He was helping Einstein work on this problem.
Yeah.
Mathematically. One day Calusa came up with an idea. He says, let's try adding a fifth mathematical coordinate. It's not physical. It lies outside the physical realm. It's a hypothetical. We really can't define it in any way other than giving it a mathematical value. And he added that fifth coordinate into the equations, ran them again. At the very end, he subtracted it back out, so all we would have left in the sum would be the physical universe. And lo and behold, that guy was the only man who ever balanced Einstein's equations. By adding this extra physical coordinate outside of space-time, Kaluza came to believe later in his career that gravity itself was non-local, that it didn't work the way that conventional physics said it worked, that the gravitational effect, the bending of space that caused gravity, was actually from some influence that existed outside of space-time and emerged into space-time as these gravitational bends.
Would that be the information?
Well, the information is the other component.
Okay, so they're two separate things. I was trying to jump ahead, I guess, and unsolved. So you're saying this? It almost like gravity is another dimension.
Well, not another dimension. It's another aspect of superphysical reality.
Okay.
Like this Wu Li I was talking about.
Yeah.
We have a form, but we also have to have substance.
Mm-hmm.
Now we're talking about the substance. See, Einstein's theory of relativity that gave us the understanding of the continuous substantive spatial field addressed the substance of the universe, but Einstein never addressed its form or order. He only gave us the description of the clay.
Ah, I like that, yeah.
Yeah, he didn't tell us about the fingers to shape the clay into all the objects we see. He never went there. He didn't have to. The substance was sufficient to change the world, and his model has been verified, like I said, thousands and thousands of times. It's the raw clay. What I'm talking about is the source of that raw clay.
The fingers.
Now, that's the structure.
Ah.
The other part of it. That's the supergeometry. So, imagine. Let's look at the fabric of space-time as a rubber sheet, very thin rubber sheet, and so thin that you might even see through it. Let's stretch it out on a picture frame and stand it up on a stand in the middle of the room. And let's imagine, and this is an imperfect model, but it conveys the right mental image. Just like Einstein in his mental experiments, his thought experiments, where he talked about transparent train cars traveling at the speed of light. Physically impossible, but it conveyed the right impression. So here we have this rubber membrane. And imagine looking at this flat surface and thinking of it about the fabric of space-time, viewing it from our physical side. Imagine on the other side of it there is a superphysical realm. It's something that we can't see, but from which physical reality can emerge. Now imagine taking an object like a coin. Let's talk about a quarter. And it's got all kinds of details, relief, the sculpted image, the lettering, all that kind of stuff.
Right.
And imagine taking that, being on the other side of that fabric, that rubber sheet, and taking it and pressing it in. So that we suddenly see a bulge emerge on our side.
Okay, yeah.
And the rubber is so thin that we can see every minutest detail of that quarter through that rubber.
Mm-hmm.
And notice that the rubber is bent and curved around the image of the coin. That's how the universe is put together in my model.
Fascinating.
Everything is made that way.
It's being pushed through kind of like from something on the other side.
Yes. In other words, there's a mechanism, which I describe in my book, that shows how abstract mathematical wave functions that we use in physics is actually a description of this process that's going on in the superphysical. And so we have this process emerging in our space-time. And it creates depressions, bends, warps in space. And then information drops in from that realm and materializes within those bubbles of space-time.
Huh.
And that's how everything in the universe is put together. This would explain a number of anomalies. Number one, it would explain why we can't find a graviton, because the object that we're looking at, like the planet, is not the cause. It's the effect. It doesn't produce gravity. It is a result of what causes gravity. It becomes an influence that's focused into the middle of those bubbles and grabs smaller objects and pushes them down on the surface of larger ones.
Huh.
So what we're actually looking at is like making a meatball. Yeah, let's say the meatball is the substance, you know, that's being assembled in form. Let's say it's the constituents, the structural constituents of the universe. Your fingers and your hand that are pressing in on that meatball are the bends of space. And the force which your hands are exerting on the meatball is gravity.
Huh. Okay. So now I'm going to circle back again on you, Thomas. I hate to do this, but now I think you've caught us up. Tell me about the predictive aspects of the model.
Yes. Yes. Let's take a look. We're going to talk specifically about paranormal phenomena now, because there's other predictions that relate to cosmology and other aspects of physics. But I want to talk about the paranormal, because as I mentioned earlier, paranormal gives us a window into reality where we actually see this materialization process
right.
occurring in real time. It makes it much easier to study. So let's imagine that inside of a quote-unquote haunted house, you know, I hate to use that word, that term. It has such connotation to it. Locations of regular paranormal activity.
There you go.
You know, we're not talking about the vacuum of the cosmos here. We're talking about a location that has what Einstein called physical content. So in the middle of the room, you have all this air. You know, you have gases, molecules, atoms. There's substance. It's not a vacuum like in the cosmos, as I said.
Right.
So imagine a bubble of space-time expanding in the presence of this physical content in the middle of a room. I liken it like, imagine the fabric of space as the surface of an old rubber inner tube, and it's got a weak spot in it. And when you pump it with air, a bubble blows up out of the weak part of the tire. That kind of an idea. The first thing that we would have is that we would have a compression and twisting of space immediately on the outside surface of this expanding bubble. Now, when it's occupied by physical content, in this case, the air molecules and atoms, that physical stress of that compressed space, Tim, is going to excite the atoms inside of those gases. And when we excite atoms with this kind of a force, we cause the electrons to get excited, and they jump up in their orbits, in higher orbits. Electrons can jump into higher orbits around a nucleus of an atom. There's a number of what they call valences that the electron can occupy. So if we had this happening, the first thing that we would be able to observe and measure in our local space would be the emergence of an electromagnetic field out of thin air.
Right.
Literally out of thin air. So that would be one prediction it would make. And, of course, paranormal investigators have verified that prediction hundreds of times. We know that these are occurrences at the site of paranormal events. We get electromagnetic fields coming from nowhere. Now, in the world of the electron, what goes up must come down. So when that excitement is expended, even temporarily, these electrons will drop back down into their lower orbits. So when they do that, electrons can emit a couple different things. First thing that they emit almost all the time is heat energy. Heat energy, in fact, is associated all the time with electromagnetic fields, because the electrons emit thermal energy. Now, in recent years, paranormal investigators have been bringing thermal cameras into the sites of investigations. And they've picked up some pretty interesting images. Some of them are so precise and so clear that you might even be able to call them a thermal apparition.
Yeah.
But when we look at these images, and we've not really had a theory by which we could look at them in this way before, with this kind of a thought process based on the paradigm I'm talking about, we see that their thermal image is fairly uniform across the entire surface of the image that's being taken. See this all the time. We never see an image that is reflective of a living being, where, let's say, if you took it of a human being, you would see very hot areas around the face, and then it would get darker at the nose and the tips of the ears.
Right. You'd see some kind of like bodily form.
Yeah, you would see contrasts in the thermal signature. You know, the hair is going to be give a much cooler signature than the face and the clothing, so on and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
But in these paranormal images, the signature is virtually the same over the entire image. It means two things. Number one, that the thermal generating process, the mechanism, is occurring over the entire image. And it's also the same over the entire image, and it's occurring at its surface.
Hmm.
So this would be another piece of evidence that would be predicted by this model and has been collected. So that's paranormal effect number two that this model would demonstrate.
Okay.
Now, at certain energy levels, we can also have electrons emit photons when they drop back down into their lower orbits. We actually exploit this, Tim, day to day in our modern world. We pass an electromagnetic field through a physical substance, excite its electrons. When the electrons, you know, cycle back down, they emit light. They emit photons, particles of light. So we can produce light without a filament or without a plasma. That's how a light-emitting diode works. So it's a known physical process. So if somebody has been following me visually so far, we're talking about in a haunted house, quote-unquote, a bubble of space-time, bubble-shaped space-time, jacketed in an electromagnetic field and emitting photons. I've just described what paranormal investigators have traditionally called a luminous orb.
Right.
That's the world's first scientific model of what a luminous orb is.
Anybody that would ask him right now what he's doing is an idiot. Not a journalist. He's an absolute idiot.
You're listening to Banal of America Audio.
But that's okay. There's some players and coaches that are idiots too.
Any other questions for Coach Boeheim? Okay. Thank you, Coach.